I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.
Today's program is brought to you by the Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheese that win more awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
I'm Erica Weitz, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, this is Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd on Heritage Radio Network. Today I have the unusual honor of interviewing a very special author, Patrick Martins, who wrote The Carnivore's Manifesto. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, Diane. Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And he's in studio, which I, of course, love, probably because he works right around the corner. And let me explain to the few listeners who may not know why you are so special on this radio station. You wrote the book with Mike Edison, but you started this radio station in 2008, and Patrick also had started Heritage Foods in 2002. Also, another claim to fame for our Cutting the Curd audience is that Patrick is married to our show's originator, Ann Saxelby. So, Patrick, what's it like to be a guest on your own station?
Well, at least you let me have my host chair, the one I always use. So I do feel a little bit more comfortable. It's kind of indented just perfect to my butt, even though I haven't been here in a long time, which is great. And, no, it's just very, very nice to be here. And I'm so proud of the station. And I actually have very little to do with the day-to-day. I'm on the board of directors. Mm-hmm. And I do, you know, meet with Aaron probably once or twice a day for 10 seconds. Or 10 minutes. But it's just unbelievable what a great job she's done and her team, Jack and Allison and Liz. And it's just a tremendous, tremendous achievement.
It's great to be a host on the show.
Great.
And it's a good thing you didn't take my host chair because then we would have had a fight. Why do you like to hide back there?
I like hiding.
At the restaurant.
Remember, I was the first one to do 200 episodes. So all this time, sometimes it's nice to be hidden.
That's true. Okay. So questions about the book.
Okay.
This is a book review show, so we have to get down to it.
I'm ready.
What inspired the book for you?
Well, it's interesting. It's a 52-to-3-page essays is basically this book, plus an introduction and a conclusion. So that is the way when I got into the food world for the first time, I wrote my master's thesis on the politics of medieval food sculptures in England and France in the 14th and 15th century. And then I met Carlo Petrini the summer after I had graduated from the Tisch School. And he's like, wow, I love what you wrote your thesis on. And he loved Rabelais, you know, and Gargantua, these old kind of comic book figures from medieval times. And he loved hearing all about this. And he asked me to come and work with him in Italy. And so basically for a year, I traveled around with him throughout Italy and throughout the United States, but also I was right in the same office as him. So I heard everything he ever said, and I heard it a million times because I heard all his phone conversations when people would come visit and all the multiple speeches he made.
You speak Italian.
Yes, I do. And he's a great you know, he's a great one-liner. You know, he's got a million one-liners, and they ring totally true when they talk about, you know, biodiversity or about people or capitalism or communism. I mean, everything he says is so crystal bell clear, and I always appreciated that. He got things, you know, very short and succinct, and through my travels with Soul Food, I got to meet other people like Alice Waters and other Michael Pollan, and so this book is kind of an accumulation of those one-liners, of those ideas. ideas plus some of my own, mm-hmm. and you know, enlarged into one or two pages.
Are some of the chapter titles his one-liners?
No. I mean, they're just inspired by. Okay. I mean, also, 15 years ago, when we were first talking about these
things were different.
Yeah, things were different. Mm-hmm. It was pre-internet and this and that, mm-hmm. For most people. So, but you know, everything is inspired by him. Like my Merchants Matter. You know, the mm-hmm. importance of middlemen. I mean, mm-hmm. he never really said that, but I sense,
you know, he'd agree.
Yes, and I also learn how he said things,
uh-huh.
which are, you know, in short, succinct mm-hmm. bits. And sometimes I think, especially when it comes to the sustainable food world, I read so many very long books, and I mm-hmm. always wondered how much better they would be if they could be, you know, edited down to 10 pages.
Right.
Then all of a sudden it might be much more powerful, and other people who are not part of the choir could maybe more easily use those talking points
right.
to inspire other people
mm-hmm.
rather than, you know, one idea that takes 200 pages. It just, mm-hmm. it's hard to change the world that way because
okay.
it seems a lot of people don't read. So
that's
I
true.
Also wrote this for all my
well,
friends
this is
who
in
don't
bites.
Care.
It's yes. in bites.
Exactly.
Yeah. So had you written any of the essays before? Because they really are essays and they mm-hmm. could stand alone.
Yes. Heritage Foods is a distributor of about 50,000 pounds of rare and heritage breed meat a week. We have a wholesale business and also a mail order business. And the mail order business requires a weekly email.
Oh.
And so I did a lot of writing for that weekly email. I also
on political topics.
Well, you know.
Or on food topics.
Yeah, as political as you get when you're trying to sell a 10-rib pork rack on the internet. But, you know, talking about diversity and finding mm-hmm. ways to succinctly write things. I mm-hmm. did once try to write a book. I've written a couple of op-ed pieces for the New York Times. And, you know, Heritage Foods is a business, but it's also a movement of sorts. So there's a lot of letter writing, whether it's a thank you letter where you're trying to summarize why you're thankful to someone for providing you meats or a mm-hmm. chef. You know, we ended up writing. We're always trying to inspire people to mm-hmm. eat less factory farm meats.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to write a lot to do that.
Did you write a proposal or did someone find you and suggest the book?
Actually, thanks to All Good Things Come Through Anne. Whenever anyone is like, how do you deal with Patrick? I'm like, I am married to Anne Saxony. Someone likes me. So Anne introduced me to Angela Miller, who's mm-hmm. a publisher, or she's an agent, but she also is a cheesemaker. She owns Consider Bardwell Farm. So she invited me to draw up a proposal. And for years, I was trying to, you know, I had some version of a proposal that was being thrown around and edited by other people, but they all came from food people. And as a result, they just couldn't break out of the way that food writing happens,
mm-hmm.
you know, talking about long bottlenecks in the slaughterhouse system and how in 1974 this law was passed that made it harder. And no, that's not the way ideas are should be put out there to the non-converted,
mm-hmm.
You know, and they need to be manifesto-ish, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so
hence the name
exactly, which is real cool. I thought that they wanted to name it that, and so that's mm-hmm. why I love my co-writer Mike Edison.
Mm-hmm.
He, you know, came from you know, a very prolific writer. You know,
mm-hmm.
the most prolific writing is the porn industry. I mean, they have so many movies and books that that industry produces. It's easy for a writer to get work that way. So he would write millions of things. He had so much experience writing, but he also wrote about wrestling, and
mm-hmm.
he was the editor in chief of High Times. He wrote for Hustler.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so he had all this experience, and that was just the kind of racy
mm-hmm.
energy
mm-hmm.
that the sustainable food movement needed.
Okay. But I hear your voice in most of the chapters.
Yeah.
I mean, I hear your turn of the phrase even.
But the co-writer is the fabric. It's the thread
okay.
of the fabric. And so that he was able to pull, he expanded the vocabulary that I use. He
okay.
brought in music references,
mm-hmm.
You know, but
how
yes,
did the actual process work?
He basically came to my house mm-hmm. once or twice a week,
okay.
every week for a year.
Oh, wow.
Sometimes he would watch me drink at a bar. Sometimes he would watch me light up a big joint. Sometimes he would watch me, like, fight with him or fight with chefs on the phone, whatever it was, you know, distributors. But he and I were able to get along, and he's very direct like me. So
okay.
I would yell at him if he was late. He would yell at me if I wasn't making any sense. But
okay.
it was, in the end, a very mm-hmm. good collaborative effort. And by the way, it's a great talent. A co-writer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, everyone's like, oh, I want to write a book, but that's not right. Most people should write a book with a co-writer.
With someone who knows what they're doing.
Yes. Now, Anne is a brilliant. She can draw. She can write. She can do all this stuff. Yes, she wants to write a book by herself. But I think everyone has a book in them. Mm-hmm. But most people need to rely on a talented co-writer that can bring out their best.
Mm-hmm. Were you an English major at Vassar?
No, but I always had a good vocabulary. Mm-hmm. You know, I speak three and a half. My mom speaks six. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the Latin roots, all the Romance languages. Mm-hmm. No, but I did enjoy writing.
Mm-hmm. But now, what did you say your master's thesis was on?
My master's thesis was in the performance studies department. And basically, the performance studies wanted to look at the world through the lens of performance, just like sociology looks at the world through the lens of group dynamics, anthropology through people relations, economy through economics.
Performance as an artistic performance.
Yeah, well, it basically says, I mean, it's one of its core concepts. This is a discipline that became a discipline in the late 70s. Guys like Richard Schechner and Barbara Kirschenbach-Gimblett and Brooks McNamara were the founders of the department. And it basically, I mean, simply says that we have behavior strips in our head. And much like hitting play on a recorder, when someone asks me, you know, what was it like writing the book? Or how many kids do you have? You're not really improvising that. You're basically hitting play on some behavior strip, like the old editing footage, you know, where it would like fall on the editing room floor. And you basically re-perform a lot of pre-performed behaviors and routines, scripts. You might have a long one. You might piece them together differently. But basically, that's the theory of it. So it was a great discipline to look at food and food as performance and the theater of the restaurant or of the main course. And of course, medieval feasts were the most gluttonous example of that. So it's kind of fun to look at them. Plus, spices and coffee and chocolates were new to those cultures. So you can imagine how exciting it was.
But did you say food sculpture in medieval feasts?
Yes, the nobility often used food sculptures.
Like, was that meat often?
Yes, it could be meat. It could be marzipan that is still lives on today as a food sculpture. It's basically a display of conspicuous consumption that the wealthy used to either intimidate or subdue or rally their guests. I mean, I think Catherine Medici was famous for having a bankrupt basically monarchy, but because she threw all these great parties, no one ever wanted to conquer. Yeah, they all wanted to be invited to the parties. That was a political tool. And, you know, before then, it was interesting. They might make a marzipan rendering of Constantinople to try to encourage all these nobles to go on a crusade. And they'll say, we'll take the city. And then they eat the concept. They eat it. They swallow it. They shit it out. It couldn't become more them.
Okay. I remember my son had a favorite book on medieval feasts, and we would look at the the tabletop and all the you know, what was it?
They had
turducken.
Well, the most expensive item on any medieval table was the neph, which they put salt on, because salt was like salary. It was a kind of, you know, monetary thing. And then their wine, the thing that spouted the wine, was always very expensive. But then, then it was also something powerful about putting so much effort into something that would be eaten, that would last so little. It really showed the power of the... So anyway, it was just a small smidgen of the entire food history world, but it was fun. No one had really written about it before. And it was great. I mean, it seemed like karma or some energy was pushing me to do that, because Carlo Petrini, when he met me for those 10 minutes, we were so fascinated by that topic that
he took you under his wing.
Yeah, and then I ran with it from there.
So it was very fortuitous.
Yes.
So who is this book for? Who do you wish would read it?
Well, to me, first and foremost, anyone who ever was moved and fell in love and admired the book Animal Liberation by Peter Singer, which is a real seminal book in 1975. I mean, it's on the level of The Omnivore's Dilemma or Fast Food Nation. Peter Singer's book was about animal rights. And he was basically, well, half the book was against factory farms, and the other half was against experimentation on animals for medicine or shampoo. And that was it. And it changed the world. And it he became the kind of grandfather of the vegetarian movement. And is a very powerful guy. And at the time, his argument was we shouldn't eat meat. So now, fast forward 30, 40 years later, with all these sustainable farms and with a better understanding of agriculture and how better or not, we do eat a lot of meat in this mm-hmm. country. So mm-hmm. maybe it's an idea that we need to come to grips with rather than try to stop. I mean, I don't know how mm-hmm. many tens of billions of hamburgers get eaten each year. So, mm-hmm. So, you know, fast forward 40 years later from that book, and I would love the people who were moved by that book to see that this is a celebration of his idea, because it's all about animal rights.
But keeping the meat.
But it also talks about meat. And it also talks about an act of intervention mm-hmm. for change.
Yes.
An act of intervention. And that this radio station is an example of that. Heritage Foods is an example of that. Mm-hmm. Active interventions to change the world for the better. Mm-hmm. Not so much discussing. Mm-hmm. And that's why we say your merchant matters. If you cannot name five people who you buy food from, then you're not part of the sustainable mm-hmm. food movement. Mm-hmm. People are like, that's outrageous. But right. it's true. Whole Foods is a fantastic contribution. But if that's where you're doing all your shopping, you're mm-hmm. not going to your beer distributor, your dairy lady, mm-hmm. you know, all that.
Has the book gotten you speaking engagements on the food issues you care about?
Yes. I mean, I'm going to speak at the SVF Foundation next Friday. It is basically, I need to find a nicer way of saying it. It's a seed bank for livestock genetics.
Okay.
So that 1,000 years from now, people could still, no matter what happens to the world, if that bank is preserved, they can still taste the Tunis lamb, which was the lamb bred by the first three U.S. presidents. Or they could taste the red mm-hmm. wattle pig. Mm-hmm. And that's very important, because you never want to have your only hope on the farm. Mm-hmm. You know, science, if science mm-hmm. can help protect and freeze some sperm for us, then that actually speaks very positively about the future and mm-hmm. preserving biodiversity. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I do a bunch of speaking events. I mean, we did a book tour. I was on NPR mm-hmm. with Leonard Lopate, which was an honor. And yeah, so
exciting. I worry that you may be preaching to the choir, which you mentioned before. Is this book too inflammatory to convince the bad guys?
Well, that's interesting. I do think that the bad guys probably don't care enough about this book. I don't know if this book is going to make enough of a ruckus or ripple effect for them to even be concerned. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely truthful. I mean, this book, I say it's not so much opinion. That's what I always loved about Carlo, is he would never speak past facts. Mm-hmm. You know, and it sounds outrageous to be like someone speaks in facts, but I think these are truths. I mean,
but I'm sure some of the people who you'd like to convince will not experience them as facts.
But I mean, you know, that they do genetically modify livestock on factory farms to suffer a bit. That's a truth.
Oh, there was some bad facts in there.
Yeah.
Bad facts.
Temple Grandin says, you know, if we didn't eat pigs, they would just be funny looking animals in zoos. Mm-hmm. That's a fact. Mm-hmm. You know, the vegetarian movement should, you know, encompass constructive solutions against factory farms. That's, you know, mm-hmm. a little bit opinion, but mm-hmm. also mm-hmm. fact that animals have feelings and that they're creative and that mm-hmm. they need natural outlets. That's a fact. So that's why I kept everything to 2 pages, because mm-hmm. at 2 pages, you can actually write, I think, an idea that is foolproof. Mm-hmm. I think people might not like it. And most of all, people might not care. That's the big thing. And I don't know if I got them to care, but that's mm-hmm. why we tried to do it with a sense of humor. Slow food should be treated like fast food. Mm-hmm. Quick stuff, mm-hmm. sustainable, mm-hmm. even if it's peanut butter. Mm-hmm. Poor people should never be told to eat turkey meat that has been fed antibiotics its mm-hmm. whole life, mm-hmm. that it can't walk or mate naturally. That's an ethical mm-hmm. thing that you're telling poor people to do. It's a health thing that you're mm-hmm. telling people to do. That's true. I mean, I don't think that could or should be argued, but I mean, obviously people might not like parts of the book. That meat is seasonal. Just like fruits and vegetables.
Topic. Let's get to that topic after the break. We have to take a break now. It's Diane Stemple on Cutting the Curd. I have Patrick Martins in the studio, and we'll be back very soon.
You are listening to Balloons by Jack Inslee. This is Cutting the Curd on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Dairy Farm Families of Wisconsin and the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board are proud to underwrite Cutting the Curd on heritageradionetwork.org. Wisconsin cheeses have an illustrious heritage of more than 170 years of quality and craftsmanship. During this long and rich history, the art and science of cheesemaking have been captured in time-honored traditions that produce cheese varieties of unsurpassed excellence. Today, Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit www.eatwisconsincheese.com.
Hi, it's Diane Stemple back on Cutting the Curd with Patrick Martins. I was just thinking about your subtitle, Eating Well, Eating Responsibly, and Eating Meat. Yes, but is that only focusing on the individual focus of your book? I feel there's a larger food politics issue. You would like to change the meat industry, if not the whole food industry. True?
Yes. I mean, I would like it. I mean, basically, I think this is the greatest vegetarian manifesto written in recent times, because it's saying if it's factory farm food, you shouldn't eat it.
Right.
Just don't eat it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we need to be eating less meat in this country. Everybody knows that.
Mm-hmm.
We all secretly know or publicly know that meat has to cost a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And that people might need to eat less of it. That's the goal anyway.
Is there a word yet for a person who only eats heritage meat?
Ooh, no, but I would like you to find one. Yeah, that's a great question.
Heritage-itarian?
Heritage-itarian. I like that. I'll leave that to Liz in the studio. She can, maybe that exists already.
Because you make up that other word.
Terroir.
Yes, yes. Now, I had trouble with that. I kept wanting to say terroir and not knowing how you pronounced it.
Yeah, tête for French, the French for head. Tête.
Right, I got it.
Yeah, the knowledge of craftsmen.
Uh-huh.
Skills.
Okay. So describe that essay. Describe what you're talking about.
Well, there's certain cities in Venezuela that just produce tons of great baseball players. No one knows. That would be an example of terroir in action.
Okay.
A number of great ideas have come out of this radio station.
Right.
Projects.
Right.
Events, policy mm-hmm. changes in state governments. Monies have been put. That's because monies have been put towards certain projects. That's because there's a terroir. This mm-hmm. is like a hotbed of information that builds on each other.
Uh-huh.
So, I think Jared Diamond wrote about it in Guns, Germs, and Steels, where there's a lot of people, you have a lot of competition, you have a lot of information exchanges,
mm-hmm.
and that society with the high population just goes faster, bigger, broader,
mm-hmm.
It starts writing, it has libraries, whereas if you're just waiting in the middle of the desert for one community to all of a sudden invent the car
mm-hmm.
or a gun, it just doesn't happen through spontaneous combustion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's basically what that chapter says, is that we need to not only look at the soil,
mm-hmm.
but we also have to look at the skill sets
and the mental aspects.
Wine and beer is a perfect example. Wine mm-hmm. is place-based
mm-hmm.
plus terroir, because mm-hmm. you have the winemaker. Beer is 100% terroir. It's not place-specific.
Okay.
You can make a German
style.
Because
you buy your ingredients.
Well, you still buy the ingredients, and I'm sure.
What about water?
Water is a good one. No, but a beer, you can make a German-style beer here in America just mm-hmm. as well as you could in Germany. That's why it's not so place-based.
Right.
Water might not have a terroir.
Okay.
Maybe it does, unless it's a sparkling
water. But doesn't it contribute, like, to bagels in New York?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Good. Knowing, yes, it's part of the terroir.
It's part of it. It's
yes.
part of it. So where do you see things changing first in the world of food politics? And what do you think we should be working on?
Well, I definitely know it's. I mean, where do I see it? I think we should be working like that guy who won the Nobel Prize for the microloans. Mm-hmm. It's all like that. Aaron Fairbanks is the executive producer, or executive director of the Heritage Radio Network.
Right.
I gave her, she came and said, I'm looking for work just for a few months. I'm like, it's the middle of the summer. Why don't you call all these goat farms around New England and try to start a goat project that seasonally sells all these goats from all those dairies. And 6 months later, she had 1,000 goats from 15 famous dairies sell to 80 to 100 restaurants in New York. That sounds like the future to me. Mm-hmm. And it's still strange that Heritage Foods remains the largest national distributor of rare meats. I was sure that within the past 10 years, There'd be another big company. Yeah, big amount. But I think, you know, investors are a little weary of the meat world. And are also a little weary, perhaps, of investing in something that, like PETA and groups like that are very much against. But we are part of the solution.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it'll happen in small projects, hipster cocktail bars or guys killing chickens in Brooklyn, for meat.
We touched on this already, but I want to expand on it. How can we get vegetarians or even vegans on board with the larger message?
Well, I mean, it's absolutely a fact that animals, by fighting just to stop eating meat, by saying no one should eat meat, all that's happening directly is that more animals suffer on factory farms.
Mm-hmm.
It's in a way, those are the big companies. We need to be, our real enemies are Purdue, Smithfield, IBP, where all the animals suffer. Fight with those guys. Don't take the foie gras guy who has 50 ducks with you. It's not a battle worth fighting. There's not enough harm happening there. So I just think people should be more aggressive against the people that are committing real crimes. And one of the ways to do that is to be very proactive about that group. By the way, I spoke at a Museum of Food and Drink panel, and I was on the panel with Peter Singer. And Peter Singer said, well, Patrick, you could never feed the world with your thing right now. I mean, with your project with Heritage Foods USA. It's just not big enough. But if all the food was produced like that, the way you're saying, all the factory farm meats, then that's 99% of my battle against factory farms would be fought, would be ended right there. That 1% being, of course, that in the end we do kill the animal.
Right.
But to hear that from Peter Singer, 99%. That would be his whole battle. They're pasture raised. They have access to the outdoors. You know, they're not fed medicine.
Do you see that happening? Do you see that?
Yes. It's definitely going in the direction of humane treatment. Temple Grandin did all that work. The Nyman Ranch did all that work. Paul Willis out in Iowa really pushed for that. You know, actors, movie actors, I think, are fighting
for
it.
That's true.
What is her name? The actress who played the swan, the black swan.
She's Natalie Portman.
Yes. She is is making a movie on Jonathan Safran Foer's book, Eating Animals.
Oh, great.
So they've been to Frank's farm to film Frank Reese's farm. So, yes, I absolutely do think it's changing.
So you think there's a groundswell?
There's a groundswell, and there's more independent people like myself just starting a business that just sells the right types of chicken. And that's really powerful. It's now, certainly not moving in the other direction.
Right. One of your chapters is called Revolutionaries Wanted, Inquire Within.
Yes.
What can the regular eating and cooking person do, you know, not in the food industry?
Well, you know, ultimately, there's no better place to fight back against the evils of the industrial food complex than at your own table with
You're
your own family.
You're reading the book. He's reading the book.
This is from the top of my head.
I see your eyeballs on that page.
I have a lazy eye. Let your kitchen be our Lexington and your pantry be our Concord. The revolution begins at home, and that's why, even if you can't raise an army of activists, we challenge you to change just one mind. Perhaps you can convince your rich brother-in-law that feeding his kids processed food every day is a bad idea.
That's a good idea.
The Carnivore's Manifesto is not about assuaging a liberal guilty conscience. It's about eating better, feeling better, and having more fun. Remind that brother-in-law that good, fresh food is not the only road to a healthier future for his kids, but it also goes better with his finances. find wine that than that supermarket crap he's in the habit of eating.
Okay, wait. I want you to now talk about, without turning the page,
okay,
what you say about knowing who you buy your food from, because I think that's a really good point. And I even paranoidly thought, oh my God, do I know those people? Mm-hmm. I finally came up with them, but I want you mm-hmm. to talk about that.
You know, being able to know who your purveyors are?
Yes.
It's just that, you know, there's the fabric of every day. There's sometimes, I know some people that all they ever talk about is just what they're doing, how, mm-hmm. oh, so now I'm going to take the subway and I need to be there at 6:45. And are you going to meet me there? Okay, so you're going to meet me there at 6:45, and that'll give us 10 minutes to get to that place. And that's all. That's actually their whole life. And mm-hmm. and with time and with email and with the phones and technology, that becomes everything. 100%. I see couples.
And what would you like instead?
The banter in line at your cheesemonger,
mm-hmm.
the saying I'm going to walk 5 extra blocks to go to my wine guy because who I know and who hooks me up and mm-hmm. who gets me that little taste, who turns me on to a sale, who tells me not to buy something because in a week something better is going to come, mm-hmm. and all these people work
more relationship oriented.
Yeah, they work all this to make money. You know, the Goldman Sachs kind of mantra, you know, of the world: make all the money you can, and then spend it the way you want,
mm-hmm.
and give some away, perhaps, and you know, get congratulations. When I think it's much more important to have that kind of expectation exist in your everyday social life,
mm-hmm.
the quotidian, and that you do get treated special mm-hmm. through actual FaceTime,
mm-hmm.
and that when you go to that same neighborhood restaurant that you always go to a couple of times a month, guess what? The chef's coming out. They're bringing you free desserts.
Like you.
They're testing things out on mm-hmm. you, and you never wait in line. That's everything.
But you're special.
No, I think that happens through consistency. All good places happen through mm-hmm. consistency.
Mm-hmm.
I went to some, like, I always remember PJ Clark's on 55th and 3rd. They never bought from us, and yet by the fifth time I had come in there, I got a handshake from across the bar, and you know, they knew my drink.
Mm.
They knew how I liked it. That's the same for everybody.
Okay.
Not because I'm special and you're special. Everybody's special.
Mm-hmm. What would you recommend that parents do for, you know, you have 2 kids, they're pretty little, but what do you envision doing as your kids get older in terms of teaching them about food?
Well, that's an interesting question. We did write a children's story. Chapter 48 or 49 was a children's fairy tale.
Oh,
I can tell you didn't get that far.
I did. I found it way too positive.
What do you mean?
I was afraid it was going to have a bad ending.
What do you mean? You wanted the small businesses to fail?
No, I was afraid they were going to fail.
Well, I know. Well, that makes a good story.
I was afraid, like, oh no, the everything machine?
Yes. Did you like Anne Saxelby's drawings in the book?
Yes, I did.
She made the 5 drawings.
Yes, I did.
He's
giving me a test here.
Basically, I think that the best thing to teach kids is from chapter 48.
Okay.
Which, let me interrupt you. I'll just say what the title is. Don't forget to feast.
You're interrupting yourself, not me.
Yes. Don't forget to feast.
Okay. I didn't remember the title.
And, you know, we just think that it's pleasure. Slow Food was a great nonprofit organization and the first of its kind in the U.S. because it was a food movement, a food organization that talked about pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked as gastronomy as a science. And this is an example of an idea that I learned from Carlo, and I attribute this to him. Gastronomy is a science, just like performance studies or sociology or psychology. And it has rights and wrongs, and there's truths in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about quality. It's about learning. You don't know what gastronomy is or what's a great wine until you've tried a bunch of them
mm-hmm.
and you see these things come out. So I would think that the best advice to give is treat gastronomy for what it really is. And big gulps are not a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
Big Macs are not a part of that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, trying different kinds of anchovies is.
Okay. Do we only vote with our pocketbooks, and can we afford to go all good food, all slow food, all healthy food?
Well, luckily for me, I stick to what I know and with meat. because mm-hmm. I'm a meat distributor. Mm-hmm. My first project with Slow Food was a heritage turkey project that mm-hmm. tried to increase the population of rare breeds of turkeys, the kind mm-hmm. that we were not eating anymore. Mm-hmm. So they were actually on the brink of extinction. So when it comes to meat, absolutely, 100%. Mm-hmm. We should be eating less meat. Mm-hmm. We should be eating more ground meat because mm-hmm. a little bit of ground can go a longer way.
Talk a little bit about that. You're big on grinding meat for a way for farmers to survive and a good way for people to eat expensive meat.
Well, it is the it is the true cost of meat. It's not mm-hmm. more expensive. The inexpensive meat, the wrong priced meat, is the 69-cent a pound turkey.
Okay.
That's what's okay. wrong. $5, $7 is the correct price for meat. So grinding helps. Basically, it's the best food portion cost in the meat world.
Does that mean you make the farmer makes good money on ground meat?
No, but if you bought a pound of ground mm-hmm. and spent $10 on it, you're like, but I could spend three. Mm-hmm. But if you spend $10 on ground meat, you could make, on a pound, you could make three big hamburgers with okay. that. So for $10, you've fed three people.
Okay.
You know, whereas with the pork chop, mm-hmm. only one person will eat that chop.
Right.
So if that costs $10 a pound, you're still only going to
It's more cost effective.
Yeah, it's more cost effective. It helps farmers. Mm-hmm. It's at the foundation of every cuisine on mm-hmm. the planet.
Okay.
I mean, from the Eskimos to people in Peru and all that. Mm-hmm. I mean, north and south, everyone's eating ground meat. Vietnam, mm-hmm. hamburgers. I mean, grinding up meat. And basically, if more people ate more ground, we would probably be killing fewer animals. Mm-hmm. We would be, again, finding a very easy-to-use ingredient that people can easily afford, even right. if it was 10 times as much as the supermarket loss leader. Mm-hmm. And yes, if a farmer is selling stuff individually and they're like a jack-of-all-trades and selling at the farmer market, any cut can get ground.
Mm-hmm.
Any cut.
But isn't it less money for the farmer if they grind an expensive cut? That's where I don't understand it mathematically.
No. That's good. Good. Very good question. The way it works is...
Or do you like throw other things in?
No. You pull out your best cuts. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, on a cow, you pull out the ribeye, mm-hmm. which is a 13-pound piece, the strip, mm-hmm. which is like a 10-pound piece. You pull out maybe the hanger mm-hmm. and the inside skirt
mm-hmm.
and maybe the brisket.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else, grind it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're only working to sell five cuts in volume.
Okay.
And then you're trying to find a burger outlet or a hot dog or a meatball mm-hmm. company to buy everything else. And there's real power in that. Whereas if you tried to sell all 27 cuts of the cow, the farmer would go crazy trying to sell all those cuts equally.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, part of the using ground is first and foremost to pull out the most expensive cuts.
Okay.
But by the way, even if you didn't, if you had a great ground outlet, you mm-hmm. could still put those more expensive cuts. That's not the goal, though.
Okay.
Your goal is
okay.
to be selling your ribeyes as ribeyes.
I have another meat question just reminded me of that has nothing to do with the book. How come hanger steak and skirt steak used to be cheap and are now expensive?
That is a very, very interesting question. I think it has something to do with the chefs
okay.
having found...
Got popular?
Yes, those mm-hmm. those cuts.
And they're delicious.
They're so good.
But they used to be great because they were cheap.
They were cheap, right. Well, that was a real find. I mean, for people like you who knew, that was the best deal mm-hmm. of the year. Now I think hanger steak is everywhere.
Yeah.
And plus it's a little bit... I like the texture of it. I used to have... hanger steak at Sammy's Romanian Steakhouse.
Ah.
And it would hang off the plate with the garlic on
uh-huh.
it. And I love the texture of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's also only, I think, 3 pounds of hanger steak per cow.
Oh, okay. So it's there's not enough of it, and that's
it's right
why
it's over
expensive.
The diaphragm, right.
Okay.
And then the skirt is the next closest, but there's not that much of
and
that.
And have oxtails gone up too?
Yes, oxtails are very popular, although I'm not a big braising fan. I
uh-huh.
always find that... you know, cooking anything for 24 hours.
Uh-huh.
First of all, I think low and slow and braised cooking like that is what kills the slow food movement because
right.
everyone puts so much effort into every dish uh-huh. that they're not eating enough good meat.
Well, and you're an impatient guy.
Yes, exactly. I want to eat right away. Sometimes I have Chinese food delivered to me while I'm waiting for my food to cook.
Okay. Well, thank you, Patrick, for coming on Cutting the Curd. It's been delightful to talk to you.
Thank you.
Everyone should read The Carnivore's Manifesto. It's a very enlightening book for all food people to read. This is Diane Stemple on Heritage Radio Network. I'll be back next month with Jimmy Carbone talking about his e-book, I Like Pig. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, are you hungry? Well, you're in luck. Meat & 3 is back for season 16. I'm Taylor Early, and we've got a whole new batch of reporters I am so excited to introduce you to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Fisher.
Asha McElroy.
Sam Girardi.
Jessica Gingrich.
Hannah from Wisconsin.
I'm a swing dancing audio engineer.
I am a future registered dietitian nutritionist.
I'm from New York, and I love rice and beans.
My favorite food of all time is a shrimp burrito.
I love watermelon.
We've also got a bonus podcast for you called Behind the Internship. Three of our reporters will take you along to show how they develop stories for this very show, Meat & 3.
Hi, I'm Danielle Flitter, a plant-based chef from Philadelphia, living in Mexico City.
I'm Sophia Hooper. I'm a bartender based in Portland, Maine.
My name is Addison Austin Liu. I am a chef and food journalist from Salt Lake City, Utah, and my favorite food is Peruvian.
Rice and beans.
Hand-drawn noodle soup.
So tune in to enjoy a square meal for your ears. And I hope you saved a little room for dessert.